boy. Yeah, that's right. We're going to ride farther and faster than the normal ride. Oh, yeah, boy. You're ready. Saddle is on and cinched up tight. Stick that head over here and let me get that bit in your mouth. Now the bridle's on. We have a special ride today, Lightning. It's a super studcast day. Time to give our fans the very best. And we're going to climb a couple of wrestling mountains and ride into history.
Yeehaw!
Super Studcast are all about different types of wrestlers and wrestling topics. The 3-hour Super Number 26 is all about two great stars, but much more. It is also about a gimmick Ron envisioned that became one of the top five gimmicks in all of wrestling history. These two stars will both be live separately on this tremendous Super Studcast because they both were the man behind the mask, the shocking Lord Humongous. The rest of America missed out as fans all over the South, from the Southeast Eastern Continental Area to the Memphis Territory, were horrified by the sight of the Lord Humongous, Sid Vicious in Memphis, and Jeff Van Camp in Southeastern Continental. Fantastic Super Studcast number 26, part 1, with Jeff Van Camp, is now available. Sid Vicious will join Ron for part 2 on Tuesday, September 25th. Saddle up for two stars, one fantastic gimmick, and how it felt to be the Lord Humongous.
Welcome, everybody, to Super Studcast number 26 with the legendary Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. And on this week's part one of Super Studcast number 26, we have Jeff Van Camp. Jeff Van Camp was, in Southeastern Wrestling, the original Lord Humongous, the Warrior of the Wasteland, and the Ayatollah of Rock and Rolla. So, right now, let's turn it over to the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller, as we welcome Jeff Van Camp. Ron, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, my man. Really looking forward to this one. This guy is a great guy. One of those talents who was young when he came to me, hadn't been around very long. And we just happened to have one of the greatest gimmicks of all time. He starts out here with me. This is the first time they've ever seen anything like this in Southeastern continental area, even around the country. I mean, this was not something that was had been highly done. And this guy seemed to be perfect for it. And he's got a little size to him, about 6'5". He weighs over 300 pounds. I assume he probably does still. Had a tremendous body. Once you put that big old hockey mask on him and those leather straps across him, and he just had that. He had it from day one. He scared the hell out of people, is what he did for 2 years in Southeastern Wrestling. And I used to take him to the ring wearing my tuxedo, long tail tuxedo, and black top hat and my cane. And I would take him down there like I was the master of ceremonies at a circus somewhere, and then open the door and let him come out, me trailing him behind. And I just love to watch those fans, how they used to run to the ring. They would run away from the ring. They would run the opposite direction. They were horrified of him. And he was perfect for my stud stable. And I'm very proud to have him on here with me today. He's a great guy. And I think you got him on the phone now. Jeff, are you there, my man?
Yes, sir, I'm here. And I appreciate you allowing me to be on your show today. Thank you, Ron.
Oh, well, you're welcome, man. It's an honor, man. It's a pleasure to have you on. For people who don't know much about you, as Lord Humongous in Southeastern, you're going to do it in Mid-South after you leave Southeastern. Jeff's about 6'5", 315 pounds or so back in those days. And like I said, I just love to follow him into the ring and watch those people in the crowd, the looks on their faces. It was really, really remarkable, and it's great to have you on here with us today, Jeff, and we're just going to talk about, we're going to go back, and where were you born? Let's just start out with where you were born, man.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for letting me be here again. I was actually born and raised in New Albany, Indiana, a little small town across the river from Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay, so you're right there by Louisville. I know that you went to the University of Louisville and you played football there, right?
Yes, sir. I was lucky enough to be honored to have a football scholarship. I played defensive tackle for the Louisville Cardinals.
Well, good, man. And, you know, I like that Louisville team, man. They have had some good teams in the past. That's a good football school. And, you know, you and I never had a chance to talk about a whole lot of things. You know, I was trying to run a business back in the day when you came to me, and I never did even know that you were at the University of Louisville and had the football scholarship. And before we go any further, I think you got two sons, and I think they both played football in college. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct. My oldest boy played for Florida Atlantic University as a quarterback. He was in the 2011 draft. And my youngest son is played football for Huntington right there in Montgomery, Alabama. And now he's a lieutenant in the Air Force.
Oh, great, man. So not only are you, and we're going to get into later in the show today, talking about what you did after you left wrestling. And I think fans will be really, really surprised at what you accomplished at that time frame as well. So you were born, like you say, in Indiana there, and you went to school at the University of Louisville, and during the time you were in school, you end up working at the Louisville Gardens, where I wrestled on many, many occasions for Jerry Jarrett and his company that ran out of Memphis. Is that correct?
That is most definitely correct. That's how I got to know Jerry Lawler and all the wrestlers. What they did, the Louisville Gardens, they hired football players to escort the wrestlers to and from the ring. And the wrestlers, Jerry Lawler and that group, saw my size and really actually invited me to be a wrestler after I got done playing college football.
Did you work out some with Lawler? He trained you some?
Well, actually, believe it or not, my brother and I used to take Austin out on Jerry Lawler. We would, the security company in which we worked for, would do all the spot shows in the northern Kentucky and southern Indiana, Evansville and whatnot. And we would drive them around and we really got to know who they are. And Jerry Lawler one day invited me to be, after I got done playing college football, to Mid-South Coliseum to train to be a wrestler. And he had an idea at the time as the Road Warriors. It was me and this guy named Pete Bowen. He invited he and I to, he played football offensive tackle for University of Louisville. And he wanted he and I to show up at one Saturday at Mid-South to train. And my buddy at the last minute got cold feet and he didn't go. So my brother and I went to Mid-South. And my brother, he'd gotten in the ring for a little bit and decided it wasn't for him. And I got up in the ring with Jerry for about 3 hours. And he said, okay, now, Jeff, you're a wrestler. And hand me a booking sheet and said, well, I said, what? Hope what? I had no idea what I was getting into.
That sounds kind of like the way they handle business up there. You know, Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler, they were the type of guys that, you know, they give you 3 hours of training and said, okay, you're ready to go. You know?
Yeah, and I did. Okay, here's a booking sheet. You got to be in this town at a certain time. And bing, bang, boom. I said, I don't know nothing, you know.
There's no pressure to that, right? I mean.
Yeah, no pressure.
That's really giving you a good heads up that you're about to go to work. So, you know, after playing football, that works out well for wrestling. I mean, it's a great combination with the sport of wrestling, and a lot of great wrestlers have come out of football programs, and obviously you're one of them. Now, early on then, you worked some with Dick the Bruiser's organization, the World Wrestling Association. That must have been after you worked. How many shows did you work for Jarrett and Lawler?
I worked for Lawler for about maybe 6 months. And at the time, he said, okay, Jeff, I've taught you pretty much what you need to learn in my area, and now it's time to go somewhere else. And he suggested Indianapolis, because I was originally from Indiana with Dick the Bruiser. And at the time, there's an individual working in Memphis area, son-in-law of Dick the Bruiser. And he invited me up to work with him, and I got up to work with Dick the Bruiser in Indianapolis, Chicago.
Jeff, are you referring to Spike Huber?
Spike Huber, yes, sir. I couldn't think of the name.
No, that's okay.
Oh, I've got some quality people here, I can tell you, with me, Jeff, that knows more about sometimes the business than I do, to be quite honest.
It's like the blind squirrel getting an acorn, Ron.
No, thank you very much, my man. So, yeah, then once you go, tell me what your thoughts were about Bruiser, man.
You know what? I got up there and one of his, I guess his son's Redbone, and we did a lot of gimmick with it. And then Jerry, there was another individual, Jerry Graham, and then Bobo Bazile, Kim Batera, worked with all those individuals. Awesome, awesome, awesome time. I learned a lot. And of course, I was still Jeff Van Camp, the football player at that time.
Right. So they announced you as a football player? I mean, that's what they plugged you as, a football player?
They plugged Jeff Van Camp as a football player, and that's what my gimmick was. And then I got a phone call from Austin Idol on Jerry Lawler one evening, and I said, man, we got this great gimmick we think you'd be perfect for. And it was in your area, Ron, Continental Championship Wrestling, Southeast.
Yeah. So, you know, I think what happened is I talked to Idol, because Idol had been in and out of Southeastern for me before, and I knew he knew quite a few guys, and I told him, because I had just kind of cranked up the stud stable, and I'd seen that movie, Mad Max, Mad Max 2, I guess it's called Road Warriors or whatever, and I had seen that character in it, Humongous, Lord Humongous, I just kept thinking about, I got a stable here, and I had a great group of guys in my stable, in the original stable. You know, I had Jimmy Golden as part of it, and I had a Boomer Lynch from Africa, and, you know, I had eventually Arn's going to be in there, and the Assassin's going to be in there, and Jerry Stubbs. And, I mean, I'm going to have a real, honest-to-God stable of tremendous wrestlers. And I thought, man, I want to have somebody that's outlandish and outrageous, you know. So I talked to Idol and I said, you know, I want to do, you've seen that movie, and he had seen it and he knew the character. And I said, do you know anybody that would fit that character for me? And he said, yeah, Ron, I think I do, man, as a matter of fact. And that's where he sent you in to me. And that's where Lord Humongous was born, in Southeastern Wrestling, about 1984. And you took off, man. I mean, fans just, they ate it up. They didn't eat it up like they wanted to come and hug you. They ate it up by being absolutely horrified of you, man. They were just scared to death of you. And you got reactions that I saw from very few people, from very few wrestlers ever. In your time up there, let's go back just a second and talk a little bit more about the Bruiser's territory up there. World Wrestling Association, it was called, you know, and WWA is what most people would remember that company as. And like I said, the talent you mentioned are pretty good guys. You know, Jerry Graham worked a long time with Eddie Graham, one of the best tag teams that ever was in the WWF. How was you're in a territory there and you're going to come to Southeastern. How was the trips up there in the WWA compared to Southeastern once you got into Pensacola?
You know, the trips up in Indianapolis, there wasn't that, the towns traveling back and forth wasn't that far. So it was close by. You know, we did TV right there out in Indianapolis, Bruiser's hometown. And, the best thing about it was, for me, like you said, there was so much talent. And I would sit back and just listen to the guys in the locker room, how to work, how to do this, how to protect the gimmick, how to just sell yourself. Because that's the most important thing in wrestling, is you got to learn how to sell yourself.
Yeah.
And I listened to them, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the business and how it works, and I guess protected the gimmick that which I was about to portray in your area.
Right. And that's going to serve you well once you get there, because it's a totally different deal than being a football player. You know, it's quite a bit different gimmick than just being a football player. Did you and Bruiser there, Dick the Bruiser, y'all win the world, his World Tag Championship?
We sure did. Up in Chicago, Illinois, we won it, and we traveled around together for a short period of time. And he was just an outstanding human being. I learned a lot from him, how to work, how not to, you know, it's just amazing that the people today, I think they just don't want to listen. They want to do things their own. They don't want to sit back and listen to the true professionals of the sport. Learn.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think by watching a lot of today's wrestling, I think a lot of those guys don't listen to anybody, quite honestly. And if they are listening to somebody, they're getting bad information. So,
oh, absolutely, you know, without a doubt.
Back in those days, you had so many great old professionals that, you know, you could spend time riding up and down the roads and learn a whole lot about what to do in the ring and what not to do. And those days are kind of gone. It's a shame, but those days are kind of gone, it seems like. And so when you come to Southeastern, we put the outfit on you. I remember the first time we put the outfit on you, and I was like, wow, this is the guy. I was really impressed, you know, because you were a big boy back in those days, and you still are a big boy, you know. And it had an impact on me, and I knew it was going to have a great impact on the other fans as we got to traveling around and doing the deal. So, who did you ride with a lot? Now, you know, I know I was a heel back in those days. I was the manager. You probably were in my van on occasion. I had a pretty nice little conversion van that I used to take guys around. And, you know, we used to make a lot of trips. And that was always fun. Yeah, it was a great group of guys. And when you got all those guys together and you had those nice old conversion vans, they're like a thing of the past. People can't even remember probably what those things look like. But they were great traveling vehicles. You had those four captain's chairs and a nice couch that made a bed in the back if you wanted to. And it just, you had everything, and you needed it because, you know, I had you and I had the assassin, and he's over 300 pounds. And I had a lot of big boys. Arn Anderson was young at that point. Jerry Stubbs, were
Jimmy
in good
Golden.
Shape.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Golden. I mean, I had a great group of guys, and I always had so much fun. I remember one interview we did in particular one time. I don't know if you remember this one, but I brought all the guys in my stable out to my swimming pool at my home. And you were
that.
The Alabama champion, and you had the belt. You didn't carry the belt, and you didn't wrap it around your waist. You always tied it around a rope and hung it from your neck in front of your body, which was cool. You know, it really that was a nice look. And I think Arn and Jerry Stubbs were the Continental champion. You were the Alabama champion. Jimmy had some type of championship. And I remember making an interview, and I had the tuxedo on and the top hat and the cane. And I kept just harping on the fact that I was, after that Continental championship, Bob Armstrong was the only guy we hadn't beaten yet. And I was saying, I want the triple crown. I want to be the greatest manager of all time. I would really get down. And I remember having such fun doing that interview the day out by my swimming pool. And you guys probably had a hard time keeping from cracking up because I really enjoyed doing that gimmick as the head of the stud stable and wearing the tuxedo and all that. It was such a good gimmick that I hated myself. When I watched the TV program back, I would go, oh, God, I hate myself.
That's awesome. You did a great job.
So it was a whole lot of fun those years that we ran that deal. And you were a huge part of it, man. You got to work with a lot of good guys there, too, right?
Oh, I sure did. I learned so much from you. You know, I'll just listen to you about what you thought the humongous gimmick should be and how it should work. And Austin, you know, I used to travel with Austin everywhere we went for the first few months of when I'm working in the air territory. You know, Austin had that green Volvo. Remember that green?
Right.
Sorry. And he would, we would travel together, and, you know, he's being a baby face out of my heel. He would drop me off about two, three blocks from the venue, and I would walk with a hood over my head to the matches.
Right. So, yeah, I know you guys. You guys were strictly kayfabe, that's for damn sure. And people aren't going to recognize you. You know, I mean, the outfit that you wore was, you know, if somebody saw you with it and standing next to it without it, they would still have a hard time picturing you be the guys wearing that mask. So,
I did a lot of fun to travel with.
Yeah, I was a lot of fun.
I did everything I could to protect that gimmick. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah,
you were great.
And, you know, Idol's a good guy. He's got all kinds of stories, man. He's about as full of it as you can get in a lot of situations. And, you know, I always like being around Austin because he's got a whole lot of stories. And we got a lot of history and go way back, too. And, you know, he was responsible. He was one of the guys that actually found you for me. And the gimmick itself is it's kind of an over the top thing. People they kind of freak out at that look. I know when I watched the movie for the first time, I'd never seen anything like the way they dressed those guys in that Mad Max movies. And that particular character just really stuck out to me. And I'm sure that you got a lot of crazy looks from fans, you know, and I got one story, man, that you probably may not even remember. I have a fiance that used to come to matches sometimes in Dothan. And she tells me the story about one night she was there and she had gone to the concession stand. She was horrified of you, like everybody else was. And she went to the concession stand and she got a Coke and she was standing there on the, you know, the old building, the big old farm center there that had the big high roof on it. And you went as a concrete platform. You had to go off the platform down to the level where the ring was. And she's up on that concrete level and there's a lot of fans milling around the concession stand. And she said she's standing there and she gets this feeling that, you know, there's somebody behind me. She said she could even feel your breath kind of blowing down the back of her neck. And she's turned around and looked at you. And knowing her, I can imagine, and I'm sure you got a big laugh out of it. She said she screamed like crazy and ran almost off the concrete platform. And, you know, just you had to get a whole lot of that when you were doing that gimmick.
I did. It was very, you know, that's one good thing about that mask. People couldn't see what I was doing. I was laughing most of the time, enjoying what I was seeing.
Yeah.
It was great.
And I'm sure you were laughing when she ran too.
Without a doubt.
Exactly the way that went too. So, you were with us for a long time, man. For almost 2 years, you had the Alabama Heavyweight Championship. I think put that strap on you probably maybe pretty quickly after you arrived. Wanted to get you over, obviously. We were doing a lot of things that were really getting a lot of heat back in those days. You know, everybody had to watch your back, and you never knew what the hell was going to happen so far as the crowds were concerned. Because we were winning a lot of matches. I mean, you can't hardly do business in the wrestling with a wrestling company if you don't have heat. So we were really cramming the heat on us all the time and keeping that part of it going good. You had great guys to work with, too, like the Armstrongs. I mean, Bob himself.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Brad was that.
Bob
was Brad's
fantastic.
Day. Yep.
Brad. Yep. Miss him to this day.
Steve, that I guess was just about to get started around that time frame. And, you know, that family right there, do you have an opportunity to work with them? They're something special, aren't they?
Oh, without a doubt. I learned so much with Bob, and it's great to see him again and just be able to just be in the same room with that man is an honor, just like with yourself. It's a great, great honor. I learned a lot from these guys.
Yeah, he's been around. He's been around for a whole long time, that's for sure. And everybody just loved him in Southeastern Continental, even in Southeastern in Knoxville. He was one of the biggest stars that ever wrestled in my companies. And just like you, I'm like you. Being around Bob Armstrong is a pleasure. And he's pretty full of it too, you know. He's a funny dude. Bob can be pretty crazy, and there's probably a lot of stories that you may have. You have any stories? You know, I don't know how much time you spent with Rob and Jimmy. Jimmy probably quite a bit. Those guys always had a great time at the matches. I don't know if you've got any stories.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah. But
only traveled with Jimmy just a short period of time, just a few matches with Jimmy. And of course, with your brother.
Yeah. You didn't get a chance to be around Rob too much. Usually he wasn't working on the years that I was working, and we kind of were swapping out on the book exchanging the book. Every other year he would book the territory, and then the following year I would book it. So, you know, we didn't really wrestle that much at the same time very often. So, you know, it's
you remember a few towns when I was over, you put me over so good, Ron. There's a lot of towns like in Florence, Alabama. We went there, and I think the, most of the whole crowd had hockey masks on. Remember that?
yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could never tell what those people were going to do and how they were going to react. No. And I remember that. Yeah. And I don't think that happened very often. It was kind of like, how does the whole crowd seem to talk, to get the same idea? So many people showed up with
amazing,
hockey mask on, and you know, I didn't see that. I don't believe in any other arena the entire time you did that. But I remember that particular town was full. Those little matches up there in that northern Alabama area and Florence and Huntsville, those towns were pretty amazing. We used to sell out all those buildings up there. And when we came there, it was a pretty spectacular event for people there that didn't get to see that much wrestling. And we had some of the best wrestlers in the world with Southeastern in 84 and 85. Once we changed the name in 85 to Continental, we just kept bringing them in. But we were lucky, and they were lucky in Florence there and those towns in northern Alabama to be able to see the type of matches we were having for them.
One of the two biggest things in my life that happened in your territories when you really put me over, when you decided Humongous need to be a baby face. And boy, let me tell you something. That night in Dothan at the Farm Center, there was people off the rafters wanting Lord Humongous to kick Ron Fuller's ass. That was hilarious. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember working with you, man. I certainly did.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, we changed. We did a whole lot of things. I mean, after a couple of years, we'd kind of utilized the gimmick as much as we could. And it was time to start to take some of my crew and have them turn on me. Either I turned on them or they turned on me. And we probably drew bigger crowds then than we did when you were heel.
It's amazing. Isn't that crazy? I had more people follow me when I was a baby face than I did was a heel.
Yeah. Kind of strange how you can do that. I mean, if you build somebody properly, it's pretty darn easy to turn them baby face and get more mileage out of them as a baby face than you did as a heel. And we had put some really good heat on you. Your gimmick was real. It was scary. And then they wanted to see you be a baby face, especially if you was going to get your hands on me, you know, the head of the state.
Oh yeah. They that's exactly what they wanted.
Yeah. So it was a lot of fun working those matches. And I ended up doing that with, I think, probably the Assassins before it's over. And, you know, we worked in a small territory that had a turnover of talent that was pretty good, but we had the same people there a long time. I was there. The Armstrongs were there. Rob and Jimmy were there. And we kind of went back and forth from babyface to heel. We had an opportunity to work with guys that we had rode down the road with. We eventually end up working with them. And it always turned out good because basically we were all pretty decent workers and we were over, and fans just never got tired of seeing us, which is really, really nice. So after you spent some time there with me in Southeastern, you're going to go on to Mid-South in the Louisiana. That territory basically went from Mississippi, just about into Mobile, Biloxi, Mississippi, west on into Oklahoma. So tell me about those road trips. How about those deals?
You know, the one more thing I'd like to mention in your territory, Ron. Really thank you for putting me over. You also had a couple of matches with Ric Flair, Birmingham, and then again in Mobile, Alabama. Remember that?
Yeah. Yes.
I appreciate that so much, and you build me a Humongous going to beat Ric Flair, and remember I won the belt from him in Birmingham.
Yeah.
On a disqualification.
Yep.
That was awesome. Yep. I remember that to this day. And I want to tell you, thank you for allowing me to work with him, and what a great champion he was and still is.
Yeah, man. You know, he was a tremendous talent, and You know, and I tried to take guys all as many guys as I could when Flair came in, when champions came in. You know, I like to put obviously baby faces with them because obviously you're going to draw a little more money using a baby face because most of the champions were heels. But it gave guys an opportunity to work with the champion, and you know, and you can't do it yourself. I mean, in a lot of territories, guys that own territories, they had a habit of wanting to push themselves so much that they had the same match with the champion 5, 6, 7 times in each city. And after a while, fans, they want to see something different. And I never did that in my own territory. I would take one or two shots maybe, but then I would give, I'd pass it around and give everybody a shot to work with the champion. And I think you end up drawing more money when you do it that way than if you just keep coming back with just the same guy against the world champion time after time.
Well, I was honored and humbled by your decision by allowing me to do that, and thank you.
Well, yeah, well, man, you earned everything you got when you were with me. That's for darn sure. And, you know, as we go through the program here, anytime you want to jump back and you want to talk about something else, okay, we can do that too. Just feel comfortable, my man, to jump in whenever you like. I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the Mid-South because it's close to where we were. In fact, we had a very unusual situation where there was an overbleed between the two territories. They ran in Jackson, Mississippi and Biloxi, Mississippi. We had television in Mobile, Alabama, which was right there, only 50, 60 miles from Biloxi, pretty close to Biloxi. And so, you know, Bill Watts and I had a great relationship. I never was concerned about it, nor was he, the fact that we could both be seen. And he was smart enough to ask me to come over and work some of his shows for him in Biloxi, especially where there was a big crossover in television market. And then I would, in exchange for me going to work for him occasionally in Biloxi, I would have him send me Ernie Ladd for Mobile, which was, wow. I mean, you know, there was a big black population in Mobile, Alabama, and Ernie Ladd was a super big name for the people there.
Sure.
Every time Ernie came and worked for me, we turned thousands away. I don't know how many people we might have turned away in Mobile on many occasions. And I would usually work with Ernie because I was his size. Ernie was about 6'8", too. He was about my height. And, you know, it was a good thing. Fans really got into it. I was usually a heel. And when Ernie came there, he was always a baby face. And we had some great matches. I remember some really super matches with Ernie. So you're over there in Mid-South. And who are some of the other guys who were there when you were there?
Yeah, actually, I moved into Pineville, Louisiana, in the same apartment complex as Dr. Death Steve Williams. And he and I traveled together the whole time I was in Mid-South. And Steve and I became really good friends. And some of the guys we worked with was Ted DiBiase, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Butch Reed, Jake the Snake, Dick Murdoch. I had a great run with Dick. He put me over big time on TV in Shreveport. And it's amazing that all the guys I work with are gone today. And I miss seeing and talking to some of these guys I used to work with.
That's a good group. How about Murdoch? Let's break that down a little bit. How'd you like working with Dick Murdoch?
Now, he was a card. He was funny. He was always laughing, in a good mood. And that man could drink some beer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was a character, man. I mean, he was crazy. Yeah, I got to say, since you brought his name up, I got to tell this little story here about Rob and I were working with Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch in Tallahassee, Florida, in probably 1973, maybe. He might have been even 72. And we're both young. Me and Rob have only been working for about 2 years, and Dusty and Dick they've been around forever. And so we start the match out, and Rob starts the match, and Dick Murdoch starts for his team. And Murdoch goes in, and they lock up, and he calls a spot. But he calls it so loud that I could hear it standing in the corner. He says, "Big arm drag." right? And he was already laughing. He was already having a good time playing as usual. And he locks up with Rob and he goes, big arm drag. And nothing happens. And I'm thinking, well, what the heck's going on, you know? And then he shoves Rob back. He pushes him back. And he looks at him, you know? And then he locks up again. And he locks up the second time. And he says it just as loud he did it the first time. Big arm drag. And nothing happens. So he pushes Rob back again, you know, and now he's got a look on his face like, and Rob goes, who, me or you? and Murdoch goes, me, ignorant, who do you think? He goes charging Rob. Rob gives him arm drag and a couple arm drags, and he scoots out on the floor and the crowd pops. You know, they laugh anyway, but you know, they don't know what's going on. But that was kind of like working with Dick. I mean, he liked to have a good time, boy.
He would keep you laughing in the ring, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, he liked the joke, and he would do it. If he had you in a headlock, he had you in some hold, he would do something funny. He would do something that wanted to make you laugh. And it was pretty hard to keep a straight face when you're working with Dick. He was a little tough, though. He was a little stiff and rugged. You know, I guess your gimmick, you know, you got that, the hockey mask on to protect your face. You're probably pretty good, easy for you to protect yourself. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, and a lot of people, it was great because people couldn't see me laughing in the mask, and I'd get him in a headlock, and he'd mumble, I rub, blah, blah.
Yeah.
He'd give you a spot, and I said, okay, let's do it. And then he wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, he's a character. He was great to work with. Tell me a little bit about Bill Watts. What'd you think about Bill Watts as being the owner over there?
Bill was pretty tough. I think he was a tough businessman, but once you saw the gimmick, you had to come up with your own spots and tell him what you wanted to do. And most of the time he would let you do what you wanted to do. And he brought me into Bixby, Oklahoma one afternoon and said, I'm going to shoot you a video. And he shot the Lord Humongous video that you see now on YouTube.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I need to look that up, man. Do you know what his headings is under? Because I like fans when we do Super Stud Cast to be able to look it up. Is there a title for it?
Yeah, Lord Humongous Music Video.
There you go. Okay, so fans out there, if you want to take a look at a video, and I'm sure it's pretty good stuff. Bill Watts put together some great stuff. He's one of the best and one of the smartest and brightest of all the promoters I ever was around, or guys that own territories. So was Stubbs there?
I didn't actually get to work with Stubbs at that time. Well, he was in your area, but not in the area of Mid-South.
Okay.
And he put me with the manager with Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I don't know if you met him or not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Go way back.
He was a card, too. He always had some pretty women next to him. No matter where you went, he always had pretty women around him.
I can't figure that out, man. How does old red-haired Oliver Humperdinck, man, have pretty women around? I mean,
that was amazing. I have no idea. But he everywhere he went, he had beautiful women standing right next to him all the time.
That really gets me, man. I used to work with the Hollywood Blondes in the early 70s in Florida. They were a great tag team, and Oliver Humperdinck was their manager way back in the early 70s. And he wasn't too pretty back in those days, so I can imagine by the time we get to 84 or so that he's not that good-looking a guy. But, you know, I'm kind of blown away to think he's been – I don't know how he gets the pretty women, that's for darn sure. So when you're taking these road trips, how about the road trips? I mean, the trips were, from what guys have told me, pretty darn bad out of in that territory.
You know, honestly, Ron, half the time I didn't even know where I was at. You know, the office would have us plane tickets, and at the time, you know, I was married, and my wife would Steve and his girlfriend at the time would drive us to Houston. We'd hop on a plane, and a week later, they'd pick us up in New Orleans, or they'd have to pick us up in Dallas, Texas. It was, I mean, we was always on the go. I mean, I didn't know half the time what city I was in. All I knew was somebody was picking us up at the airport, taking us to the hotel. And then we'd go work out and go to the building where we was working. And then they would take us back to the hotel and hop on another plane.
You know, I'd heard stories about that territory. I mean, when you're running as far away, you're in Mississippi and you're going to work in Tulsa, Oklahoma the next night. That's a pretty good distance. You'd have to fly. You'd have to fly to a lot of those. You wouldn't be able to drive.
No, because, you know, the office, you know, they take it out of your paycheck. And we would, you know, like you said, we'd be in Oklahoma City, Tulsa. And then the next night we'd be in New Orleans. There's no way. I mean, we were always on the go. Now, Steve had a big old van, like you said, with the captain chairs. And he and I would change off of driving his big old GMC van he had. And we would go try to make as many shows as we could, like Jackson, Mississippi. And then we'd go to Shreveport. As long as we was in the Louisiana area, we would drive. And once we got to Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, we'd have to fly.
Yeah, once you're way out there, man, you can't drive those distances. It's really, really difficult. So I can imagine. I never worked for him over there, but I would have enjoyed it, I'm sure, because he always had great talent. So, you know, let me just ask you a question about being a wrestler and basic wrestling question. Did you prefer wrestling with bigger guys or smaller guys?
It didn't really matter to me. You know, the bigger guys would put me over just the same as the smaller guys. And we, you know, I'd do the same courtesy back to them. It didn't really matter to me, to be truth, Ron.
Who was your favorite guy you ever worked with?
All right. I think one of the best wrestlers I ever worked with was a guy named Jake the Snake Roberts. And he and I had a really good run together in Mid-South. He was just an awesome guy. And you know, after the match is over with, we'd go out and do a little partying and just had a great time. He was a great guy.
Yeah. I know Jake very well. And he and he is a good guy, a very, very likable guy. I heard you mention something earlier about Butch Reed. Was Butch Reed there?
Yeah, he and I worked together as well. Butch and I worked very well together. It's amazing. You know, we put everybody over. Nobody had a big ego. We all knew what kind of gimmick each other had. We had to sell each other. And it was, I mean, we worked very well together. It was a really good group of guys, and they were all professionals. I really enjoyed and learned a lot from these individuals. And it all goes back to one. From the beginning, you know, working with Jerry Lawler and Austin Idol and Dick the Bruiser and Jerry Graham and Ken Patera and Bobo Brazil, just learning from those guys and then coming to your area. It's amazing. You know, you work very well together. Nobody had a really big ego in the territory in which I was in.
That's good.
I really enjoyed the time.
That's good. I mean, you know, it's not always that way. Not all territories are like that, but you happen to be in some good ones, obviously. Did you happen to be there when Butch Reed and John Nord had the fight in the dressing room?
Yes, I was there. You know, John, you know, they Bill Watts tried to tag team Nord and I up together.
Right.
Well, Nord, you know, Nord and Jake the Snake entered the ring and they was thought at the last minute, you know, people was getting thought that they would both tag team up against me, and then Nord the Barbarian and I turned against Jake he was going to tag team us both up. And I was in the locker room when Nord and Butch locked up. It wasn't a pretty scene. And shortly thereafter, Nord left the territory.
Yeah. Explain that fight. You know, people, fans out there, they don't get to see these fights in the dressing room sometimes. And, you know, can you describe a little bit of what went on in that one?
Well, I can remember, I know, you know, the attitudes, you know, somebody got hit more than what they did and try to put somebody over a little bit more than what they should have. You know, every once in a while you do get attitudes, and attitudes happen, and they just went at it, fisticuffs in the locker room. And, you know, Bill Watts didn't want that to happen. And shortly thereafter, Nord didn't stick around too much longer after that. He left. It's a knockdown, drag out fight, that's for sure, in the dress room. And, you know, that just doesn't, you know, you got to have camaraderie and teamwork. And that type of attitude just doesn't fly.
Yeah, you don't want to get that. I mean, you don't want that. I don't remember having very many fights in my dressing rooms. I have seen a few though.
I
remember one in Orlando. I remember one in Orlando, and when I was a young boy, I'd been about the business for maybe a year in, and Dick Slater and Bob Wharton Jr. were wrestling in the ring, and they had a little problem. I was watching the match. I could tell there somebody's not happy with what's going on up there, and they brought it back to the dressing room, and it started again. In the dressing room, and it didn't last very long because Slater had that big right hand, and he was a bad son of a gun, and he knocked out Junior, Orton Jr., and after he knocked him out, I saw Slater do this to two or three guys, but this is the first time I got to see it. He knocked him out, and then he drug him into the bathroom. And he put his head in the commode and shoved it and flushed the commode.
Flushed it. Wow.
And I couldn't figure out that part of it. You know, I remember watching him drag him in there. And then I went and looked to see what the hell he's going to do to him. And he just put his head down. That's how he brought him to, basically. He shoved his head down in the commode and flushed it. And
Ron, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is that the famous fight where after he did that to Orton Jr., Orton Sr. was there, and he turned and looked at the father and said, yes. If you want any of this, old man, come and get it.
There you go.
Orton Sr. just sat there and didn't do anything.
He never got off his butt, man. I mean, you know, he watched that punch, and I don't believe he wanted any of it. And yeah, and he did. Dick went right back in there around the corner past me and looked right at him, said, hey. Oh man, you want some? Well, I tell you, Dick Slater was maybe one of the baddest guys in wrestling. He really had a great punch. He not only knocked him out, he did this to the big football player that I wish I could remember his
Matuszak.
Name. Matuszak. He knocked Matuszak out and flushed his head in the commode in the hotel room. Yeah, and he was still in high school. Matuszak was hanging around the beach in Clearwater at spring break, and somehow they got into it, and they went back toward the room, and I think Slater popped him in right there by the room door and drug him in and stuffed his head in the commode and flushed it. And then he told him the word, the story I got was, and Matuszak's a big, strong son of a gun. I mean, he's going to be first-round draft pick or something, right? And after Slater knocks him out, Slater's just a high school boy, knocks him out, and then he comes, when he gets him to, he says, how much longer are you going to be here? Matuszak says, 3 days. And he said, I don't want you to see you out of this room for 3 days. He quarantined him for 3 days after he beat the hell out of him. So, you know, Slater was a mess, man. He was something else.
You know, he was in Mid-South the same time I was in Mid-South.
Yeah.
Slater was.
Oh, there you go, man. I'm surprised you didn't get to see one of those big right hands, you know?
No, actually I didn't. He was the booker. He was one of the bookers at the time.
Well, you know, I mean, once you do that two or three times, nobody really wants to have some of that, you know, so they don't have much trouble after they see that a couple of times. They know who to mess with and who not to. So, yeah, I was going to ask you about Jake the Snake. I'm glad you brought him up because, you know, Jake the Snake's a good guy, good worker, and I'm sure you guys did have good matches together.
I met him again last year at the reunion in Dothan, and then he and I went fishing together up in Minnesota this past summer. Last June, we flew up to Minnesota together and drove over to a lake over in Wisconsin, and for a week we fished and hung out together. It was just a great time getting back to know one another.
Hey, what a great deal, man. That doesn't happen very often with guys, you know? That's a heck of a deal right there to be able to do that.
Let me ask you, Ron, after I left the Mid-South, I mean, how much longer did Continental stay in business? Because I know you left there and went to Knoxville.
Right. We sold Continental in the fall of 1987. to a guy named David Woods that owned a television station in Montgomery, Alabama. And I went to Knoxville and started my last wrestling company called USA Wrestling that I ran for about 7 months. And then I sold that company to the same guy. But pretty much after you left, we were only there about a couple more years after that.
Wow. Well, you had a great thing going. That's for darn sure. That was probably the best area that I ever worked with. You're an amazing boss and great guy. And I I'm very honored to be a part of your organization. I can't wait to see you again this coming May at the reunion.
Yeah. We're going to both be in there at Dothan about the middle of May, which is I'm looking forward to that as well. So, Jeff, I guess you've got some questions for him.
Yes, I do. So, Jeff, let me go back to the very beginning of the interview when we were talking about your time at the University of Louisville. And you were there, I know you're freshman and sophomore year, and you had some sort of injury. Was that between sophomore and junior season?
It sure was. I had an ACL injury to my right knee. And the doctors pretty much told me at the time if I continued playing football, I would walk with a limp for the rest of my life. And I chose not to do that. That's the reason why I was talking to Jerry Lawler, and he talked me into being a wrestler. And I shortly thereafter left the University of Louisville, and I didn't finish my degree yet. I went back later on at Troy University in Alabama and finished up got my 4-year degree, but I left there and became a wrestler.
Well, just because I'm a big sports fan, in particular a football fan, I was doing some checking. You played with some pretty good ball players, like you played with Frank Minifield, who was a member of the All-Decade team of the 1980s for the NFL, 4-time Pro Bowler for the Cleveland Browns, and you played with Mark Clayton, one of the original Marx brothers for the Miami Dolphin. So that's some pretty good pedigree that Louisville team had, huh?
The big guy you actually missed was Joe Jacoby, Washington Redskins.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty – one of the Hogs, absolutely. So good stuff.
Yeah, Boy, let me tell you, I'll give you a story. First time, being a freshman going in, and Joe was a senior, and I thought I was Barney Badass, and I went against Joe, and let me tell you, he slung me around like I was a nothing. And I learned my place real fast, real quick with Joe.
He humbled you, huh?
Very, very quickly. I had to learn how to run around him.
All right. So another guy I want to ask you about that you mentioned was Jerry Graham. We have a lot of people that listen to the show that were longtime Jerry Graham fans. And, as many stories as there are about Jerry Graham inside the ring, as Ron mentioned, his famous tag team with Eddie in the New York area. But there is many stories of Jerry Graham outside the ring. Did you experience any memories with Jerry Graham outside of the ring?
You know, in the locker room, he used to give me a lot of good information about what I needed to do and how I do it. And he gave me actually a couple phone numbers to New York. And he at the time, he told me I wasn't ready to go. I need to be a little bit more polished. And he told me the reason why he thought I wasn't ready. But he gave me phone numbers to the promoters up in New York. And I called him anyway. And Jerry gave me a push. But, actually I turned him down because he told me I wasn't ready. And I listened to him. And I had to tell him thank you for everything he did for me in the Annapolis area.
Okay. And then of course, the other guy I wanted to mention that discussed briefly with Ron was John Sutton, Oliver Humperdinck. Did you get to spend any time outside the ring with Hump? Cause he's quite a man of the world.
You know what? We only got to, at the hotel rooms a little bit. He was always around a lot of pretty women. Every time I tried to get around him, he was just, in the locker rooms, he'd go back there and he'd close the door and these women and then they'd all get dressed together. And like, dang on, how's he so lucky enough to get these pretty women?
So, and finally, one of the most famous angles that you were ever involved with when you mentioned your time in Mid-South was, of course, the angle where you've got the hockey mask on and Jake gives you the DDT. And for the first time in Mid-South, someone gets up from the DDT. Do you remember that angle?
I sure do. Yes. He thought it would be a great angle if he did the DDT on me, and then he would lay across me, and at the count of two, I would push off, and I would raise up and sit up like, Jason.
Yeah.
And then, you talking about a pop. Oh, everybody in the whole audience, oh, my God, I can't believe this. And then I would pick up and hit him, and one of the assassins would throw a chair in the ring. Remember that? And then he would, I would tie him up in the ropes. And as I was walking to him, he'd take off his boot and hit me, and I dropped the chair in the middle of the ring, and he would DDT me again on the chair.
And that was the go home?
Yeah, that was the finish.
Well, that ought to do it. I'd say that ought to do it, by golly. You know, DDT on the chair, you know, even with the mask on. No, Jake's a good guy. He's a really good guy. He's a lot of fun, too, to be around. He's another one of those guys. So we want to, toward the end here, I want to ask you a little bit, man, let's get past the wrestling. After you finally retire, you actually studied criminal justice. Is that right? In college?
Yes, sir. I did. Okay. I got my 4-year degree in criminal justice with a minor in social studies. And then I have an associate's degree in general education.
So in 1989, you finally start to use that degree. You join the Escambia County Sheriff's Office. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct. I went to, I started the Crime Stoppers program in Pensacola. Actually, it started before me, but I didn't really hear anything about it. Didn't know anything about the Crime Stoppers program until I got in charge of it. And I started the TV program called Wanted Fugitives. And believe it or not, Escambia County Sheriff's Office has over 100,000 warrants for people's arrest. And 30,000 of those are serious felonies arrest. And I thought, man, these people need to get picked up, because every time there's a warrant, there's a victim behind every one of those warrants. And I said, man, we got to get these people off the street. But we started the TV program and offering rewards for people's arrest and off and getting the general public to tell us where these people are. And they'd get a reward based on the information that they provide to law enforcement and get their money. Up to rewards of up to $1,000.
Good program, man. Sounds like a heck of a deal. It's kind of similar. The program's kind of a little bit similar to the America's Most Wanted type of deal.
It was. But, it was similar to America's Most Wanted. We mirrored it out after that program. You know, in 1996, America's Most Wanted was going off the air, and America kind of pushed it back on the air. So we did it. We wanted to do something on a local level, and we couldn't call it Most Wanted. So we called it Wanted Fugitives. And we profiled 20 fugitives a week and put the pictures up on the screen and kind of described what they were wanted for. And we would ask the general public to get involved and give us information where they're located. And a few years later, the Escambia County Sheriff's Office put me in for Officer of the Year. And 2004, I was the Officer of the Year for the state of Florida.
Super.
I actually helped capture over 10,000 people.
Oh, there you go, man. 10,000 people off that program.
Yeah. Over 10,000 people I caught from that TV program.
That's amazing, man. I know, too, and the Crime Stoppers. You were in the Florida Association of the Crime Stoppers. You became president of that, didn't you?
Yes, sir. I sure did. I was honored by the Florida has 67 counties, and I put my name in the hat, and they elected me as president, and I was president of that organization. And at the time, a lot of people didn't realize, you know, paying rewards cost a lot of money. So we actually have we decided at that time to get a bill passed through the Florida legislature that says that any criminal who's arrested in the state of Florida has to pay $20, and $2 of that goes to the local Crime Stoppers program. And it's overseen by the Attorney General of the state of Florida, and you have to apply for a grant once a year to obtain the monies. And you're talking a little over $5 million a year goes to the local Crime Stoppers programs in the state of Florida. And that was one of the bills that I helped pass. And I'm very happy to say it is doing very well.
Oh, man, it's a great concept, you know. And I think you're being a little bit humble, man. I've heard that you're one of the small number of serving police officers ever to draft the legislation that passed in Florida. Pretty darn amazing, man, what you accomplished there. Is that program still out there and available today?
It is. You know, the program's still available. You know, I'm no longer involved with the Crime Stoppers organization, but it is most definitely the statute is still there. People are still aware. Every person gets arrested has to pay $20 to the local Crime Stoppers program. And three of those $20 goes to the clerk of the courts who helps collect those funds. And the rest of the money goes to the Attorney General's office to be distributed to the Crime Stoppers program in the 67 counties in the state.
Amazing.
So it's actually a really good thing. So I'm proud of that.
I can tell you as a former clerk of the court in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale, I have seen those costs imposed, the $20, Jeff.
Oh, you have. Well, then you know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's tremendous. That's a tremendous thing to have accomplished, Jeff, right there. Especially, you know, after becoming a wrestler, before you even apply your skills in the officer department to make that type of thing happen, it's pretty darn amazing and a great credit to you, man. So you end up, you left the Escambia County Sheriff's Department 2012. I guess that's when you went down, you went further south, correct?
Yeah, actually, you know, I was at the time I was going, my wife had left me and I was going through a divorce. I worked for a short period of time with Okaloosa Airport Police Department right there out of Fort Walton. And then I became a granddaddy and my oldest son's a police officer in Boca Raton. So I moved south to be closer to him and my grandkids. And I worked for Ocean Ridge Police Department. And unfortunately, I on a traffic stop on August 7th, 2018, I was at 4 o'clock in the morning, Ron, if you don't mind me telling you this, me and my partner, this guy was driving south of the northbound lane. We thought he was a drunk driver and we tried to pull him over. And I was probably about 20 yards behind him. And as I was getting out of my car, he put his car in reverse and hit me head on.
Oh.
And I rammed his car. And it went into and I hurt my shoulder. And I, at the time, I believe I had a heart attack because I didn't know. And I passed out and I remember waking up in the hospital. And I've had two shoulder surgeries since then. And I had to medically retire from law enforcement October 2nd of 2019.
You're lucky to be alive.
Yes, sir. I'm very late. Two more seconds or another second. I was getting out of my car. And he ran me as hard as he could. And he fled the scene. He was an 11-time convicted felon. He had his license had been suspended 8 different times. He was on probation at the time. He was sitting on a .45 automatic with 31 rounds ready to go. He was an illegal immigrant. And he had 7 bags of cocaine in the car at the time. And we had no idea who we were pulling over. And now we're supposed to go to court with him. In April of this year, in a couple more months, I'm supposed to go to court.
Well, I hope that goes your way, man. I hope that comes out, putting you in better shape. I never realized you had the shoulder problems a couple of years ago. The last time I saw you, you look just like you always look, and you look very healthy.
I appreciate that.
So I guess, Jeff, we're pretty well through for today, And I want to thank you, man, for coming on. This has been an extremely interesting program for us. And our first, this is part one, and we're going to be joined for part two with Sid Vicious, who's had a little run with Humongous as himself. And we're going to do that one on the next one. But we really, really appreciate your time today. And thank you so much for being here. I mean, obviously, fans, after they've listened to this program, realize that you weren't just a wrestler in your life. You've actually accomplished a heck of a lot after wrestling and within the law enforcement part of what we all need and what's so important for all of us all around the country is you guys that go out there every day and take care of all of us are just very, very important to our country and what we're all about. And thank you very much for being on with me today. And it's been great talking to you. I've learned some things about you today I didn't know myself. And most of the times when I do these Super Studcasts, that's what I find happens. I end up learning things that I never knew about people that I thought I knew everything about. So thank you very much for being with us today. And look forward to seeing you in middle of May down in Dothan, Alabama for the reunion there that takes place every year.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for allowing me to be on your show. I'm honored and humbled that you asked me to be a part of your program, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple months.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ron, we would like to thank Jeff Van Camp, your original Lord Humongous in Southeastern Wrestling. That it was a great interview, Ron.
Well, thank you very much. He's a great guy, done a lot. He had a great career, a short career, basically, for most wrestlers. But, you know, he's accomplished so much. I'm so proud of what he's accomplished after he got into his chosen profession, basically law enforcement. And he's really accomplished a lot there. And great having him on. And, you know, I always like to hear names that I don't get to hear very often. And all the wrestlers that are traveling all over the world and back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of the guys we talk to basically on our Super Studcast is they always bring up those names that bring back memories. And it was a great one today. And we've got part two coming up here, right, Jeff?
Yeah, part two will be released on the 25th of this month and will feature the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller sitting down and chatting with Sid Vicious. Sid Vicious also worked the Lord Humongous gimmick. And Ron, I know the fans are going to wait for that one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to wait for that one, actually. I mean, Sid Vicious is a trip, guys. And he had a lot longer career than what Jeff Van Camp had, obviously. And he's been with all the big companies. He's been managed by my brother for quite a few years for WCW. And he's got great stories. And he's had a great, great background. And we're going to get into a little bit more of the Humongous thing. And we're going to talk about a whole lot of parts of the country and a whole lot of different ownerships and promotions that he worked for. It should be a very interesting one. And
it's always, a good time when you got a guy that headlined a WrestleMania.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, he's done it basically. He's done it all. And, you know, it's a great opportunity for us. And it should be a great time for fans, and I'm looking forward to it. And I want to thank all of my Studcast and my patron fans out here for being interested in staying with me. And it's a growing number every Super Studcast, and we're doing our best here to bring you some great stuff. And I think this one, hopefully you will enjoy. A lot of people may not be familiar with Lord Humongous, but if you look at the photo. When you get your, wherever you get your Super Studcast from, whether it be from Patreon or the website, TN Stud, you're going to see Jeff Van Camp, the version of it. And then we will, on part two, when we put that one up, we're going to show you what Sid Vicious looked like as the Lord Humongous as well.
All right. Well, for the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, and our producer, Sweet Lou Kippelman, I am Jeff Bowden, reminding you that the Super Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next time, when the story continues.
Thank you for being a patron and supporting all Studcasts with your donation for this month's Super Studcast and the rest of the story. We're honored to bring these super events to our growing list of donors and appreciate your comments and feedback so we can continue to improve upon the 3 hours of unique and focused content we hope you've enjoyed. We encourage you to tell your friends about the Super Studcast and the rest of the story so the stud can continue to highlight the awesome history of his family and the sport we all love. So saddle up and ride the second and fourth Sunday of each month as we open the vault and spotlight wrestling history. This is David Summers thanking you on behalf of all the staff, including the great Brian Last and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains. Another Super Studcast is done.